dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are always thrilled to be able to pick the brains of one of the most intelligent men in Washington, Hans von Spakovsky, better known to us as HVS. He is a former senior official in the Justice Department. He is also a man who has rendered service at the Federal Elections Commission. He is an author of important books, co-authoring sometimes with his friend and ours, John Fund, on matters involving election fraud, entitled Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, and also a terrific profile on Eric Holder's Justice Department entitled Obama's Enforcer. Hans, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
So, topic A is impeachment. You've recently written about how the impeachment process works, but before we get into any of that, what on earth is going on with the Democrats and their relentless intent to take down this presidency now over this alleged improper behavior in a conversation with the president of Ukraine?
Well, it was interesting to me that Nancy Pelosi, you know, held a press conference before the transcript of the Ukrainian conversation was out and before the supposed whistleblower complaint had been publicly disclosed. So, you know, you have to wonder, was she going forward without actually having any facts in front of her?
Let me just ask you to stop on that point, because I did my commentary on this, and it seems so out of character with this very calculating, this very disciplined, longtime Democratic operative, that I was forced to conclude that she must have figured that it didn't really matter whether they had the goods this time any more than they did in the Mueller report, but that one of the actual objects of the exercise may have been taking out Joe Biden, not Donald Trump. What do you think about that? If Democrats want a more progressive candidate than him and want to get him and his liabilities out of the mix.
Look, I don't know if the intent was towards Joe Biden or not, because I think Democrats seem to be pretty obsessed with the president. But that actually may be the effect of it, because if you go past concentrating on the president and you look at the underlying facts, Joe Biden, when he was vice president, used his authority as vice president to threaten the Ukrainian government with withholding $1 billion in loan guarantees unless they fired the Ukrainian prosecutor who was investigating the energy company that had put his son on the board and was paying him an outrageous $50,000 a month.
You say used his power. I think that really does come down to abuse of his power, no?
Yeah, and that is one of the key things here. And I am frankly not surprised that the president, in his conversation with the Ukrainian government, because he had previously talked about his concern about corruption inside Ukraine, you know, asked the Ukrainian government that they ought to look into that. Now, that's being painted as a way of him using his office for personal reasons because Biden is a candidate for president. But I think that ignores the fact that he was the vice president when he was doing this. And it seems to me that's something that everyone would want to look into. Did he use the powers of his office for personal reasons? And that's the claim being made against the president. But we have clear evidence of that on Biden, because he actually admitted it. I think there's videotape of
him. There is videotape of him, for heaven's sake. And this raises the question. I keep hearing from media outlets that, you know, there's absolutely no substance to these claims against Joe Biden, and they're groundless and, you know, without foundation. You've served in a senior position in the Justice Department. You've got, you know, a good grasp of the law and, you know, what constitutes criminal activity. I mean, are these claims groundless based on, among other things, that confession, if you will, on, or boasting at least, by Joe Biden on that videotape?
No, I don't think they're groundless. And I think there's enough there that it ought to be investigated. I'm not going to tell you that I think he broke the law or anything like that, but there's certainly enough there to investigate. The other thing that folks are ignoring is, remember, that wasn't the only potential corruption he talked about in the phone call. He also talked about CrowdStrike. Well, CrowdStrike was the cybersecurity organization that took a look at the DNC computer hacking and came up with the claim that the Russians had done it. But there were also rumors that Ukrainians were involved in it. And the president in his phone call said to the Ukrainian president, look, it'd be good if you could look into this. Were any Ukrainians involved in this? Well, this is not being mentioned by the Democrats at all. Wouldn't they want to know whether Ukrainians were also involved in the hacking of the DNC computers? I mean, there the president seems to be doing something that would benefit the Democratic Party, but that's being totally left out.
Well, I have a theory on that, and let me just run it by you, Hans. The theory is that they are very happy with CrowdStrike's unsubstantiated pronouncement that it was the Russians who got into their servers and emails. There's something that, by the way, as you know, and I just would ask you again, as a man who's had some experience with law enforcement, have you ever seen anything quite like this? The FBI just took CrowdStrike's word for it. They did no forensic analysis of those servers themselves at all.
No, yeah, I didn't understand that either. I don't understand why the FBI would do that. You and I both know they have some very skilled experts inside their cybersecurity office there, and I'm just astonished that they simply relied on an outside vendor.
A vendor to the folks who had an interest in having the story be, it was Russia, not, as some have alleged, an inside job. I mean, this just stinks to high heavens. So anyway, just to bring us to full closure on this investigation, where do you think, as a result of the interrogation, I guess is the right word for it, of the acting director of National Intelligence yesterday, this caper stands in terms of grounds for impeachment and the likelihood that the Democratic House will move down that road?
Well, I think they are going to move down that road. One of their big problems is that very prominently on the first page of the whistleblower complaint is the whistleblower saying, well, I didn't witness any of this. This is all secondhand accounts. Well, that means it's hearsay, and there's a reason that hearsay is not accepted in any state or federal court anywhere in the country, because there's no reliability on it. So they're going to have a tough time, I think, unless they can get the people that he supposedly heard this from in as witnesses. That may happen, but even then, if that occurs, whatever those witnesses say, if it's different from the publicized notes and transcript, well, then you're going to have a conflict on, well, who's telling the truth.
Right. It seems like a very improbable basis for the removal from office of the President of the United States, meeting the test of high crimes and misdemeanors. But you will be watching it closely at the Heritage Foundation. Hans von Spakovsky, thank you for your time today. We'll talk to you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the smartest guys I know when it comes to the Chinese military and the threat that it poses to the United States and, well, for that matter, to the free world more generally. His name is Richard Fisher. He is a senior fellow at the specializing in Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He has advised others, including the congressionally chartered U.S.-China Security and Economic Review Commission, which is an indispensable source of second opinions on what's going on in China. He has also written for Jane's Defense Weekly and many other outlets over his very distinguished career, and has really established, I think, the reputation for absolute reliability and extraordinary insights into the challenge we're facing from China. It's great to have you with us, Rick. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to start by simply saying there are a lot of threats, and we talk about them in the course of these programs with great regularity, and you're knowledgeable about most and a go-to guy, for that matter, with respect to them. But let me just enumerate them very quickly. I invite you to talk about them if you'd like, but I do want to focus mostly with you on your special area of expertise, the military. But just in the interest of being fairly complete about the natures of the challenge we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party, there's, of course, the economic warfare component. Specifically, of course, we're seeing it in the context of trade, but it's so much more than that. The kind of unrestricted warfare, the asymmetric threats that the Chinese have written about since 1999 and posed to us, including cyber warfare. The strategic power projection that they're doing through this Belt and Road Initiative. And it's just important to keep in mind that this is happening across the broadest imaginable front. And before we get into the military piece, anything you'd like to say about all of that, Rick?
China's goal is to obtain a position of global military superiority as soon as it can. It basically tells us that it expects to reach that position by 2049, 2050. But if we step out of the way, fail to arm ourselves, fail to organize our allies, fail to invest in future technologies, we could see that transition take place much sooner.
Mm. You mentioned the military dominance, but it really is bigger than that, isn't it? It's global dominance in every domain, it seems.
Absolutely, Frank. Yes. Military dominance is necessary in order to enforce dominance in all of the other realms, in order to make leaders around the world bow to China's desires in all of the other realms, political, economic, cultural, what have you. But you're absolutely right. An enterprise like the Belt and Road Initiative has recently been revealed to be a military network gathering institution, as well as its previously well-established role of providing massive amounts of money to fund infrastructure projects, which double as an elite influence gathering mechanism that also transitions into a military network building mechanism.
Sure. And physical infrastructure, bases, airfields, transportation networks, and the like, all of which, as they become essentially, if not actually, wholly owned Chinese subsidiaries, they are going to be brought to bear by the People's Liberation Army. Make no mistake about it. Rick, one of the things that caught my eye is an article that Lauren Thompson of the Lexington Institute wrote at Forbes on September 12th. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this. He's reporting on the rising alarm in official circles in Washington about Chinese counter space capabilities. You've studied this closely over many years, and I know you are as aware as anybody of the limitations on what can be discussed in this domain, simply because it's generally highly classified what we know about what they're doing. But based on their writings, based on your study of what they've been doing, and based on other open source materials, what can you tell us about what the Chinese are up to in the high frontier, and what are the implications for us?
China seeks to control the Earth-Moon system as a prelude to controlling any eventual evolution toward what we call the space economy. That is a transition of Earth-bound economic activity increasingly to the moon and potentially to Mars, as a resource and potentially a manufacturing a base. The Chinese space program is completely dual use. It's controlled by the People's Liberation Army, and everything that happens in the Chinese space program is designed to serve a military as well as whatever overt non-military function they're admitting to.
You know, it's interesting, Rick. When I was in the Pentagon a lifetime ago, it was in the fairly early days of the International Space Station. It was transitioning under President Reagan from basically just a U.S. asset into one that foreign partners would participate in. And I remember Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense for whom I work, had an idea that we ought to be able to have a dual-use feature to it as well. And the idea completely caused heads to explode at NASA, but also, of course, in foreign capitals where use was going to be made of this space station. And there was no such constraint, obviously, on the Chinese communists. And to the extent that they control the Earth-Moon system, as you call it, Rick, what does that mean for our use of space? And talk about dual use. I mean, we use it for all kinds of purposes, of course.
Well, Frank, getting back to the space station, Chinese space station, it will also be dual use. It's modeled after stolen Russian technology. It'll look just like the early Russian Mir space station, which means it'll be built of a series of modules that can be replaced by other modules as needed. Modules armed with lasers, modules armed with warheads to strike targets on the Earth. And when China is able to exercise increasing control over the Earth-Moon system, it will have dominant control over the conduct of warfare on Earth. The ability to see something before your enemy sees it, to be able to communicate faster than your enemy can communicate, all contribute to the ability to find the enemy, strike first, and win first. And that is an advantage that the United States has enjoyed for decades now. China fully understands this and wants to push the Americans out of the way in space so that they can have that advantage.
And it's hard to overstate what it would mean for our warfighting capabilities if we could not rely on the use of space or even just use it as fully as the Chinese will be able to use. But also, Rick Fisher, it's an enormous problem for our economy, which has become increasingly dependent over the years, not just on space for communications, of course, but for everything from mapping to timing, which, of course, underpins immeasurable numbers of transactions, Wall Streets and others. So, I mean, it really could be a key ingredient in the domination and ultimately the defeat of this country, no?
Certainly. I mean, when all Americans are unable to buy gas from the gas pump because the global positioning navigation satellites that run their timing clocks fail and it can't process transactions, you're going to have 100 to 200 million Americans within the next 30 minutes yelling at the U.S. president not to engage in the war that China is dragging us into.
Yeah. A China lobby of unprecedented proportions, needless to say. Hey, Rick, I did want to ask you before we run out of time about one other thing. On the 1st of October, the Chinese Communist Party will be putting on a big celebration for the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. This is always a field day for close observers of the Chinese military like yourself, because they usually accompany with a parade that demonstrates some of the hardware that they've acquired, military hardware, particularly missiles, that they want to brag about as evidence of their power. What do you expect to see, and what does it say more generally about the Chinese nuclear buildup?
Well, Frank, this parade's main theme is going to be a missile parade. We will see three new ICBMs in this parade, but really four, because the Dongfeng 41, DF-41, has two versions, road mobile and rail mobile. But there will be a new liquid fuel 10 warhead ICBM, a new 1-3 warhead mobile solid fuel version of the DF-31, and of course the DF-41 is credited with being able to carry up to 10 warheads. With these missiles going into service now, enter in service and populating larger numbers of brigades, China is on a path to, if it so chooses, to match the number of warheads of the United States and Russia, making future arms control with Russia very problematic to impossible in terms of being able to ensure the security of Americans. But the parade will also feature one, possibly two new low-altitude capable hypersonic theater strike missiles.
We have to leave it at that, Rick Fisher, but we look forward to a further visit with you. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say we are joined by Peter Husey, a man who has thought long and hard and helped an awful lot of the rest of us think much more seriously about such topics as nuclear deterrence. And he's often done it in a very convivial and congenial setting of lunches and breakfasts and dinners in Washington, well attended by policymakers and congressional staff and others in the hoi polloi who are concerned about these subjects. He is these days the director for strategic deterrence studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. He has also served in other capacities, notably with the American Foreign Policy Council, but he also runs geostrategic analysis. Peter Husey, it's so good to have you with us again. Thank you for taking a few minutes.
And wonderful to be on your show again, Frank. Thank you.
Peter, we were just talking with a mutual friend of ours, Rick Fisher, about, among other things, the state of the Chinese nuclear threat to the United States. And it serves as kind of good background or backdrop, maybe, for what I wanted to talk with you about, which is the state of the U.S. nuclear deterrent to threats from China and Russia, and for that matter, Iran and North Korea and perhaps others. Could you just give us, in a short form, how you see the state of America's nuclear triad, as it's called, the strategic forces of the United States?
Yes, yeah, so we have a force that's the oldest it's ever been. It's remarkable in the fact that it's lasted this, but the ICBMs, land-based missiles, are 50 years old. The B-52 bombers were about 70 years old. And the Ohio-class submarines are all approaching their hull life, which is over 40 years. We have to replace them all because we basically went to sleep at the end of the Cold War. And as General Herensack, who was head of the Air Force nuclear program, said at one point, he said, we went on a nuclear holiday, which he's right. We did. We fell asleep. So we've got very old systems, and the older they are, the more it costs to sustain and maintain them. And we now have plans in place approved by Congress to replace each of them starting basically in 2029 through 2042. And then we will be completed building 400 Minuteman missiles, which would GBSD, it's called, Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, build 12 new Columbia-class submarines, and build 100 new B-21 bombers with cruise missiles.
Peter, when you say that they're approved by Congress, my understanding is that the House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith of Washington has been very much bent on a sort of minimum deterrence posture, which wouldn't involve much, if not any, of that stuff. Where do things stand in terms of his efforts to scupper the strategic modernization program you've just described?
You know, what he said in committee hearings as well as in speeches said that he knows he doesn't have the votes to sustain his position, thank God. But he says he wants to, quote unquote, start a debate, which he certainly has. The House fully approved the bomber and the cruise missile and the Columbia-class submarine. But they did, for the first time that anybody's ever remembered, They cut out a huge amount of money, a third of the money for the D-5 missile program for the submarine. And they cut $85 million out of the GBSD program, which would enable it a decision to be made next year to go ahead with the full research, development, testing, evaluation program. The Senate, on the other hand, has fully funded all of that. And in fact, the Senate added money to the land-based GBSD program. And my prediction is when you finally get an appropriation bill sometime around Thanksgiving, you will have fully funded the submarines, the bombers, and the ICBMs.
Peter, I understand that there's some question as to whether or not Nancy Pelosi will allow an authorization bill to be approved this year for the first time, and I can't remember how long it's been. More to the point, Peter, would it matter in terms of what you're talking about to these vital strategic modernization programs if there isn't an authorization bill?
Technically, I would like to have an NDAA because there's so many other things having to do with pay, personnel, acquisition authority, all sorts of things I need. But if I just get an appropriation bill, historically, we've often end up passing the authorization bill after the appropriation bill, in fact, the next year, like January or February, because people get embarrassed about it.
Are there issues with respect to new starts of programs?
No, that's only with a continuing resolution.
Okay. But if there isn't an authorization bill, but there is an appropriations bill, this is a bit of inside baseball probably for a lot of our audience, Peter, but it's really important to understand whether we're going to be able to actually modernize the strategic forces as you're discussing. And honestly, it's awfully bloody late, to be honest about this, but at least it has to be done now.
When you're facing enormous threats from Russia and China, it's stupid. And the Democrats should be told that in no unmistakable terms, you are jeopardizing the security of the United States of America.
Now, Peter, just speak to that for a moment, because, you know, there are a lot of people, I don't think probably in our audience, but certainly in others' audiences, who are probably under the misapprehension that, as you mentioned, when the Cold War ended, that, you know, the need for these kinds of systems, the expense involved in overhauling forces that are now really obsolescent, is not required. But what would you say to them?
Well, here's the issue: is every year from the end of World War II, when we dropped nuclear weapons, to the nuclear weapons modernization programs we did, there are basically 10 to 12 years between one modernization effort to the other. When we finish the one we currently are on in 2042, the midpoint of that modernization era is 2036. We will have been 47 years late, okay? So we're four times as long in this modernization cycle than we did in the previous three.
Yeah. And does that matter, Peter? Specifically, one of the things I've been worried about over the years is the nuclear warheads themselves, which are really old as well. They're not designed to be around this long, right? Are any of these weapons? And does it matter if they are?
No, we are doing a service life extension program on all the warheads. That's very expensive. In fact, we're spending more money on the warheads and the laboratories where we do nuclear weapons than we are on the platforms, the new ones, the new platforms. And in turn, we are spending more money sustaining the old systems than we are building the new systems. The new systems, miraculously, add them all up, $8.2 billion. And that's 100% of the bomber costs, of which you can technically say 100% of the bombers are conventional. We would build them anyway. So we're spending $8 billion a year to modernize our nuclear deterrent. We spend $11.5 billion going to the movies every year. So when you look at it, that's the smallest part of the nuclear budget. The next biggest is command and control and communication, which is how do you do command in a cyber war, in a cyber environment, and then the warheads, and then maintaining the old stuff. And it all adds up to a miraculous number of $34 billion a year, which is about 3% of the defense budget.
3% of the defense budget, and yet it is, I believe, and I think you do too, the single most important part of it, and therefore one that we should not be treating with the kind of indifference or lax attitude, shall we say, that we've exhibited to this point. Peter, because we have allowed this high priority programmatic activity to sort of twist in the wind, the industrial base that supports it is not nearly as robust as we would like, I think. Discuss that a little bit. The number of suppliers that we have for our strategic modernization force, and there's been an issue raised recently about capacitors, which are not quite a dime a dozen, but almost, and the fact that we can't rely on the ones that we had planned on using because they may not be secure. Would you talk about that too?
That is true. One of the things that this administration did, and I think even the previous administration began looking at it, is where the heck are we getting all these parts off, commercial off the shelf, they're called. And some of them were coming from crazy places like China, which is like, you don't want to do that. Our big ability to build submarines, the Navy has the same industrial force that it had for many years. Your ICBM force, you've had Rockwell and TRW bought by others, so you have consolidated. And your rocket motors, you're down to Aerojet and ATK, and we used to have two more, but we don't anymore. So yes, given the neglect since the end of the Cold War, we have reduced our industrial base. But the industrial base we have, and I know all of them, are extraordinarily talented. And because they now know we're going to go doing this modernization effort, they're now attracting people, and it's like post-Sputnik. We're building rockets, and we're building missiles, and we're going to build submarines. And so there's, like in the space business, there's an excitement about, hey, this is a real huge national effort, national priority, but we got a lot of old folks with gray hair, and we got a lot of young folks, but we don't have a lot of people in the middle because we kind of went to sleep. Everybody retired. So we got a ways to go to get the industrial base up to snuff, but the Pentagon people, and I was just talking to a former CAPE chairman today, is we have the capability to do it. Congress has to give us funding, which means, for crying out loud, get off your duff and finish the defense bill.
Yeah. Amen to that. Peter Pusey is our guest. And Peter, let me just say, does it worry you that we have one supplier for strategic bomber aircraft, one supplier for the new ground-based strategic missile?
No, it doesn't, because it's not one supplier. Northrop Grumman or a company like that may be the prime, but underneath that, it has a total of about 26 companies, all of whom are the top notch in the country, everything from Lockheed Martin to Raytheon to Aerojet. To
competition continues at the subprime level.
All of the subs will compete with each other for this, doing both of this. So you have and they've really scrubbed these numbers for the last 5 to 7 years in order to qualify to even bid.
Right. So you get the benefit of both technical benefits as well as hopefully cost benefits of such competition.
I'm amazed at the talent in our aerospace industry, even despite the fact that we went to sleep for the last 25 years.
The malign neglect, I would call it.
Some of it was because we were stupid and thought history had stopped. And then some of it was fighting two wars that were just spending us blind. And the other one was massive cuts in the defense budget by the Obama administration, over $1 trillion. That was malignant neglect.
Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that. I'm so grateful for your time as well as the work you do at the Mitchell Institute, among other places. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us soon. Take care, my friend.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Joseph Heumeier, one of our go-to guys on matters involving our own hemisphere. Some call it our backyard. I think of it as our front yard. And unfortunately, there are some pretty unsavory folks who have been taking up residence there. And it's not often that we get to report to you a bit of good news about such things, but I think this is one of those occasions. And I'm very pleased to have Joseph here to share with us some of the insights from his new paper at the Gatestone Institute, where he is a distinguished senior fellow. He is also a writing fellow at the Middle East Forum, and most importantly, the executive director of the Center for a Secure, Free Society. He is a combat Marine veteran and always a welcome guest here. The author of, or co-author, I should say, editor as well, of Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, which again forms the backdrop for our conversation with Joseph today. Joseph, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
So the idea that Iran, which the president rightly described at the UN General Assembly this week, is one of the most dangerous nations in the world, has a rather significant presence in our own hemisphere, front yard, backyard, whatever you want to call it, it's close at hand, is a really ominous thought. You have been a voice in the wilderness, I'm sorry to say, for a long time about this, and your book is an extraordinarily important contribution documenting the problem. But tell us what you found is now beginning to happen in Latin America with respect to Iran and its proxy, its foreign legion, if you will, Hezbollah.
Yeah. Well, Frank, I think you're right. This has been an ongoing challenge, something that many of us, including yourself and others, have been paying attention to. Iran's very quiet, subversive, and strategic presence in Latin America. But there's a complete pivot from previous governments, particularly the Obama administration, its attitude and kind of their perspective on this, and the Trump administration. So I literally say night and day difference from when the Obama administration finished and the Trump administration began in 2016. And what you began to see is a very silent war, I want to call it, basically a silent war happened against Iran and Hezbollah's presence and activity in Latin America. Now, they didn't go robust and try to just immediately bully our allies and neighbors into looking at this. They did a very gradual, strategic approach to understanding that the only way you fight their networks is to build our own network and to strengthen the network, and they've done so. And I think the evidence of that now is that we have two countries in Latin America and increasingly others considering the official designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. That's a long time coming in Latin America, the last region in the world that really is to do this. Obviously, we had this debate in Europe. We're still having this debate in Europe. It took a long time for the Europeans to come to grips that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. And now finally, under the leadership of Mauricio Macri in Argentina, the Latin Americans had done so as well. And that momentum is there. Argentina designated Hezbollah on July 16th. On the heels of the 25th anniversary of the Amia bombing in Buenos Aires, the big attack by Iran and Hezbollah in 94. And then Paraguay did it in August 9th. And now there's at least three other governments that are seriously considering doing it. And we're not going to stop until we think until the entire region designates Hezbollah and has a proper understanding of the threat from Iran and Hezbollah in the Western Hemisphere. Yeah.
Well, your tirelessness in this regard is really appreciated, needless to say, Joseph Humeyer. Let me ask you, Paraguay is a big deal because its territory forms part of the so-called tri-border area. And that's a place where Hezbollah draws upon a huge Lebanese diaspora, as I understand it, and has had safe haven, effectively. Tell us what, as a practical matter, it means if countries like Argentina and Paraguay are beginning to designate this outfit as the terrorist organization that it is?
That's a good question. Let me start with the latter first. Let me start with Argentina, then I'll touch on Paraguay. And you're right, it's very important because of that presence in the tri-border area. But with Argentina, it was very important to be the first country to do this because many of the countries in Latin America, their attitude, you know, some were very complacent on this, and their attitude is essentially that if the only country in Latin America to be bombed, to literally attacked by Iran and Hezbollah, which is Argentina, and referring to the Buenos Aires bombing in 1994 when they killed 85 Argentines and injured several hundred, taking down the Jewish Community Center. If Argentina doesn't even recognize Hezbollah as a terrorist organization after being attacked by them twice, then why should anybody else? And I think that was a symbolic way of kind of showing that now Argentina's changed that position. And they did it very, very methodically. They understood the sensitivities to, you know, Lebanese communities, the diasporas, even to their own population. And I'll give you an example. Like, they created a public registry, which is their version of a foreign terrorist organization list. So they have a public registry of over 1,000 names and entities of people that are connected to foreign terrorist organizations. Now, one of the reasons they didn't want to call it a foreign terrorist organization list is because the term list has a very negative connotation in Argentina since the dirty war period. So they were very sensitive to how they did this, and they did this in a very methodical way that, you know, I think it's going to prove to be successful over time. However, you flip it over to Paraguay. Paraguay has that same problem. So Paraguay doesn't have a registry. Their executive decree essentially just recognizes that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. And as you mentioned, they also mentioned Hamas, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda in that same decree. So they have a little bit more work to do. But you're right. I mean, the Abdo government in Paraguay, the president of Paraguay, knows, and he knows that Hezbollah has a major foothold in certain cities in their country, particularly in the tri-border area, a city called Ciudad del Este. However, he has to wrestle with making sure that he doesn't damage the relations with the Lebanese community in this. And what I've told them, and I said this, I was just in the tri-border area in August, and then I was in Argentina in July during the announcement of this. And what I told them, I said, the Lebanese diaspora is our partner in this. We have to work with them to root out the bad apples. The reason why Hezbollah has been able to grow the way they had is nobody paid attention to the diaspora. And other than just commercial activity and, political fundraising, no one actually tried to talk to them about Hezbollah.
Enlist their help.
And enlist their help. And so it became almost like Hezbollah kind of drove a narrative. This was all fear-mongering. That the people, only the people that talk about Hezbollah are the Americans or the Israelis. The Latins don't care about this, and this is just a political-driven agenda. Well, that's changed now because it's not, as the Latins say, the gringos talking about this. It's Latin Americans talking about this.
Huge, huge deal. And I should have said, of course, Argentina is part of the tri-border area as well. So that is also important that they've taken that step. What about Bolsonaro's government? I would think that they would be very supportive of this as well. Is there any sign that they're going to quickly become part of a tri-national response to the threat in their own tri-border areas?
Yeah, so border is the final country in the tri-border area, the only country now that hasn't designated Hezbollah. And I should say, I think it's the first time I'm going to say this publicly, and I obviously alluded to this in the article. The Bolsonaro government right now is weighing options on how to designate Hezbollah as a terrorist organization in the country. The political will is there. The roadmap has been laid out from Argentina and how they did this. They're in close conversations with the Argentine government about how to do this. There's obviously different legal structures in these countries. And so in the case of Argentina, they use their anti-terror law, and then they use the terror finance provisions within their anti-terror law to make this happen. Brazil's anti-terror law is much more new. It just got ratified in 2016, so they don't have all these legal mechanisms. And they're also weighing whether this has to be approved through their Congress, their Brazilian Congress, which it would be different in the case of Paraguay and Argentina. So it's a little bit more challenging in Brazil. It's a much bigger country. There's a very, very big Lebanese population. And with that, I should say Hezbollah and Hamas have a big lobby in Brazil. However, the Bolsonaro government is already well advanced into doing this, and I think it's a matter of time before they announce something.
Well, I certainly hope so. I just would say this is a digression, I guess, of a sort, but it reemphasizes really the importance of the caliber of leadership that we're seeing now in a number of these nations. I was at a meeting at the United Nations this morning that was addressed by the foreign minister of Brazil, Ernesto Araújo, who did an absolutely stupendous job of talking about his government's commitment to Christians who are being persecuted around the world. And I take that as another very important sign of the new course that Brazil is on, and hopefully that it will help, as you say, in this regard, resting out those who are persecuting Christians, but also threatening the rest of us as well in Iran and through its various proxies. Joseph Heubauer, it is always an extraordinary privilege to have a chance to pick your brains about this important part of the world that gets altogether too little attention from so many of us. And I hope you come back to us again very soon, and that the rest of you will do the same again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.